Chidinma was waiting on a judge to sign her divorce papers when her estranged husband showed up at her house one night with a handgun and a machete. For nearly 2 hours, he screamed at her, pistol-whipped, punched, and sexually assaulted her. He also strangled her.
He single-handedly, as he's strangling me and I'm up against a wall, he lifted me off of my feet and moved me from one room into the bathroom. And when he let go, I was seated on the vanity. And I felt as though I was going to pass out. I felt my voice box or my throat was closing in. And it was the most scary experience situation I've ever experienced.
Chidinma says paramedics, prosecutors, and even her domestic violence counselor never asked her about the strangulation. It was her doctor who picked up on it when she went to him days later complaining of a sore throat and difficulty swallowing. She says she felt silly, embarrassed even, for not recognizing these symptoms of strangulation. She thought she just had a cold. She says she doesn't remember the strangulation being addressed at all during her husband's trial. It's hard to get domestic violence survivors to describe their experiences. It's often re-traumatizing to talk about it, even among people they trust. But Chidinma shared her story through Kelsey McKay, a former Texas assistant district attorney who built her career prosecuting domestic violence and strangulation cases. McKay now educates first responders, prosecutors, and others on how best to approach non-fatal strangulation victims. Monroe County Prosecutor Chris Gall and Middleway House Executive Director Deborah Morrow teamed up to bring McKay to Bloomington for a seminar at IU Health Bloomington Hospital last month. Gall opened the seminar by explaining the challenges inherent in strangulation cases.
In a strangulation, a victim's breathing or blood circulation is cut off, and it can result in serious injury or even death. And because strangulation can occur without even leaving a physical mark, perpetrators may tell the victim that they won't be believed. There may not be any physical or medical evidence to corroborate a victim's statement, resulting in what some people call a he said, she said case.
Monroe County prosecutors handled 50 cases of strangulation in 2017. Gall says many strangulation victims experience such trauma that they have difficulty recalling their experience. Sergeant Rebecca Schmuel is with the Indiana University Police Department. She is experienced in handling assault cases and attended McKay's seminar.
Lots of times we get a description that I was choked or he put his hands around my neck or I don't remember a little bit of it for a while, but without any visible injuries other than maybe a small red mark, it doesn't appear as bad as it is.
According to the California-based Strangulation Institute, 68% of domestic violence victims are likely to experience near-fatal strangulation by their partner. A victim can lose consciousness in as little as 5 to 10 seconds. Death comes within minutes. Some visible signs of strangulation include tiny red spots on the face, neck, or around the eyes. Victims may have a bloody eyeball, or a droopy eyelid, or droopy facial muscles. Swollen lips and tongue, and of course bruises and scratches, are also common. But a constellation of symptoms often go unnoticed by first responders, social workers, and prosecutors, like memory loss, ringing or bleeding in the ears, a raspy voice or laryngitis, changes in vision. Even if there are outward signs of the trauma, they may fade before the victim's case makes it to trial, leaving the crime difficult to investigate, document, and prosecute. In 2006, Indiana changed its penal code to elevate strangulation from a misdemeanor to a felony. Indiana is one of 38 states that have elevated the charge for strangulation. With a misdemeanor charge, a perpetrator may be given a surety bond. That perpetrator could be released back into the community after posting as little as 10% of their bond. A felony carries a larger bond amount and the potential for a stiffer penalty. Monroe County Prosecutor Chris Gall says 4 or 5 years ago, Monroe County judges instituted a 24-hour hold on perpetrators in all domestic violence cases involving battery.
In other words, a person would not be allowed to bond out for 24 hours, which gives additional time for safety planning, getting to a safe place, getting property together from the shared home, giving additional time for a victim of domestic violence to get to a safe place and institute a safety plan. After we did that, the state statute required a 12-hour cooling off period. But for Monroe County, we've had 24 hours for several years now.
Gall says the state's penal code change now reflects the seriousness of strangulation, but it doesn't provide any guidance on how to gather better evidence.
So the act and the criminal intent, they're usually a recipe of, you know, 4 or 5 things that you have to prove, each of those things beyond a reasonable doubt to a jury. And so, you know, each of those elements are things we have to make sure that we have evidence to support that element.
That's where McKay comes in. She spent 6 years of her 13-year career exclusively prosecuting strangulation cases.
And what I found during that time is that none of her cases had any evidence other than she couldn't breathe, no visible injury, good luck. And I guess by nature of not wanting to lose all my cases, I started figuring out over the years that if we asked different questions that tied directly to impeding the circulation of blood and airflow, you might actually get some good answers. For instance, when you cut off the circulation of blood to the brain, that can affect the auditory and the optic nerve and a variety of other nerves. So I trained our law enforcement officers to ask about visual changes, to ask about changes in sound, and then to ask about changes in how their throat felt or their ears felt or whether they felt nauseous. These types of things that I know as a prosecutor directly linked to the element of impeding the circulation of air or blood.
McKay developed a strangulation supplement form to guide investigations at a crime scene or at the hospital. McKay says victims are often not able to participate in the prosecution of their attacker.
So what that means is really what we get that night is really what we get stuck with, and we don't get anything else.
McKay says this means first responders have to take on the additional roles of detective and prosecutor when questioning strangulation victims. Using the strangulation supplement, a first responder would not only ask if the victim was choked, but they'd also ask open-ended questions that prompt descriptions, like specifically whether the victim lost consciousness and how their body felt while being suffocated. The strangulation supplement also provides a symptoms checklist that goes beyond whether the victim can breathe. For instance, it prompts the responder to ask about changes in hearing or vision, whether it's painful to speak, if they have trouble swallowing, nausea, disorientation, and so on. McKay says once first responders in her area started using the strangulation supplement, she began to see credible descriptions she could use in court.
So it's one thing to say I couldn't breathe, it's another thing to really kind of graphically describe a sensory feeling that would be very difficult to make up. For instance, I remember one victim said, it felt like my glasses were too strong. The way she described that was that feeling of like putting on your grandparents' glasses that are really thick and aren't your normal prescription. And I thought, you know what, who could make that up? Some other examples are we ask, you know, what did your throat feel like? Because that allows us to gauge how much pressure was used. Did it go so tight that it impacted and created some trauma on the trachea? And victims will use descriptions like, it felt like the sides of my throat were touching. Or it felt like afterwards, it felt like I had strep throat, like that feeling of it kind of being painful to swallow. So rather than just saying, yeah, it hurts, we're able to get these kind of vivid descriptions of, okay, it hurt, but describe to me what that hurt feels like.
When air and blood flow are impaired to the brain and internal organs, the body powers down and we begin to lose consciousness. McKay says victims can often vividly describe this experience.
I have had people describe it from things like it felt like a good nap, so it felt like a dreamlike state. I've had someone I remember describe it as that feeling of like taking painkillers, so kind of feeling a little woozy and high.
The jugular vein on the side of our necks is very vulnerable. McKay says it takes very little pressure to close it off completely, only about 4 pounds per square inch. That's about 1/5 of the amount of force it takes to open a can of soda. McKay says with only a slight change in the angle of strangulation, the carotid artery is cut off as well.
Some other examples that are indications of leading up to loss of consciousness are the optic changes, auditory changes. So I've had people describe things like, when asked about how it affected their hearing, they'll say things like, it felt like a shell over my ear. And, you know, anyone who's been to the beach as a child and put a shell over their ear knows exactly what that feels like. And what's actually happening when they describe things like, it felt like I was in a subway station, or it felt like, ringing in my ears, these types of things. What's actually happening is the blood isn't flowing to the brain, and thus the auditory nerve is being affected. So it then allows a prosecutor to take that piece of evidence and tie it directly to the element of impeding the circulation of blood. And on the other hand, you might get descriptions of the head. Like, I hear a lot of people say it felt hot, it felt big, it felt like it was going to explode. And what that means is the blood is probably going up, so it's going up the carotid artery, but it cannot come down the jugular vein. So the jugular vein is the first thing you'll cut off, and that's what carries the blood from the brain back down. But if you go deeper, that's where you cut off the carotid artery that takes the blood from the heart and the lungs up to the brain. And so it makes sense that the first thing you hit is the jugular vein as you squeeze on someone's neck. So what victims don't necessarily know that they're telling us is that it is consistent with, for instance, the jugular vein being cut off, but not the carotid. When they describe their head feeling hot or feeling big like a balloon that was going to explode, these are very credible descriptions of the impediment of blood flow.
Strangulation can cause permanent brain injury in a variety of ways. McKay says oxygen deprivation to the hippocampus, the part of the brain that makes and stores memories, means victims may not remember the attack.
There is this whole category of cases that I've even prosecuted to juries where the victim still to this day has no memory of the event. Sometimes they'll have a memory of the beginning of the strangulation. Sometimes they have no memory of the strangulation. They just remember waking up. And so when the first thing that gets cut off is basically your memory maker and your memory keeper, those memories don't necessarily come back later. This is a challenge that I see in the field all the time, because law enforcement isn't taught about that. So they think, oh, she can't remember, she's lying. We're taught that inconsistent versions are a sign that someone's lying. But none of these rules hold true with strangulation.
McKay refers to a recent case where the victim had no memory of the attack.
We had a trial in February where he ended up getting 50 years. And to this day, she has zero memory of the strangulation. The last thing she remembers is him hitting her, and then she woke up in the hospital, and she remembers that it hurt to swallow. And based on that, because we had a trained nurse and a trained detective when she said that, we were able to get a confession out of him acting like we knew he had strangled her. And so it's important that law enforcement be informed about these other types of cases, and we don't rely on the victim being able to tell us about the actual strangulation, but that we are trained to identify signs and symptoms that are consistent with strangulation, because that's a perpetrator who had killed someone and was on parole for a 48-year sentence when he almost killed this woman. And to this day, I believe he thought he killed her. She was unconscious for over an hour, and she wasn't conscious until she was in the hospital for, I believe, over an hour. She restored her consciousness, but she never regained that memory.
Domestic violence advocates say strangulation is actually a common tactic used by perpetrators precisely because the effects are less visible than other types of physical abuse. Without much visible evidence, perpetrators may tell their victim that no one will believe them if they say they were attacked. Both Gall and McKay say a perpetrator may repeatedly strangle a victim, releasing and then reapplying pressure to the neck, emphasizing over and over that the perpetrator has power and control over the victim. Middleway House Executive Director Deborah Morrow says if the victim fights back, the perpetrator may actually show more visible injury than the victim. She says her biggest fear, then, is that the victim could be arrested for domestic violence. Gall says strangulation can lead to an even more devastating result.
The research nationally shows that if there's an attempted strangulation, then a victim is 7 times more likely to be the victim of a homicide. So in other words, strangulation is a risk factor. It increases risk, and there's new research coming out that's even going to increase that risk factor from 7 to 15 times more likely to be the victim of a homicide.
McKay says there's a tendency for victims to downplay what they've experienced, either at the scene or later. She says this ties into the reliance on visible evidence of strangulation.
What I see happen is, even though they might outwardly minimize it, for instance, the abuser has said, oh, you don't even have any visible injury, or no one's going to believe you, is that they start to buy that. And they start to even doubt themselves whether or not it was a big deal, because they don't see visible injury themselves. In my experience, though, when you start asking victims about this, it helps to begin validating that process. So, yes, you may not have a bloody gunshot wound, but what you experienced was bad. And so I think it's very important that first responders take the opportunity to educate victims about the seriousness of strangulation so that they can be validated in their experience and they don't go on minimizing it. So if we go into them acting like they're not that big of a deal, she's going to surrender herself to that and accept it. If we go in there and acknowledge that it was a big deal, my guess is we won't get as much of that minimization.
Sergeant Schmuel with the Indiana University Police says she also has seen victims minimize their trauma.
Victims don't want to admit that they are victims. They don't want to have that label placed on them. So having an officer that can speak with them in a manner that is non-judgmental and lets them know that whatever they say, the officer is going to investigate what has happened to them.
McKay observes that many victims still carry the trauma of strangulation even decades after the event.
It is so much more common than people think, and I think that the biggest issue with not validating it is then we do end up with an entire community of victims who can't talk about it because they're that traumatized. If we were to validate them from the beginning, it's something I think that they could speak of.
Gall and Morrow brought McKay to Bloomington with the hope of increasing the community's success in responding to victims of non-fatal strangulation. They hope to get first responders to replace closed questions with open-ended ones that coax out the more descriptive details. Here's McKay again.
What I noticed as I look at not just the offense reports we would get, but really the traditional offense report in a strangulation case by an untrained officer, they pretty much read identical, and this is how they read. Victim said that she was unable to breathe, I don't see any visible injury, and that's where it ends. So what I've taught officers is, you know, saying someone couldn't breathe isn't really valuable evidence, because when it comes to credibility, anyone could answer yes or no to that question. So one of the things I've taught officers to do is not focus on the question of could you not breathe or could you breathe, but to focus on the angle of, well, what was not normal about it? Because that's where we get the descriptive adjectives. So, for instance, going to a crime scene and saying, were you able to breathe, really leaves the victim with one of two answers, yes or no. And then the investigation kind of comes to a stopping point. What I've talked to officers about is to identify, well, what was not normal about the breathing? And then I ask them to describe what are ways breathing can't be normal. And it opens it up to things like, you know, it was my breathing was short. It was hyperventilating. It was deep. It was shallow. It was gasping. And it teaches them that there are all these different adjectives that can be used to describe what is not normal about the breathing, because that is the element that we have to prove. And people tend to think the only way to investigate whether or not the airflow wasn't circulating is by saying, well, could you breathe?
McKay adds that, in some cases, questions about the victim's physical experiences aren't being asked at all.
How would an officer know to ask that? And most victims don't mention things like that because they don't know they're important. And oftentimes, they don't even know they're necessarily important to the investigation or that they even relate to strangulation. I've had many victims, when I ask after the fact, do you remember feeling nauseous, who will tell me things like, oh, well, yeah, but I think it was from my medication. We'll come to find out that's a medication they've been on for a decade and never been nauseous from it, except for the night they were strangled. So victims, just like officers, don't tend to be experts on strangulation. So they're going to find something that makes more sense. So if they have a raspy voice, well, it's because I was screaming for help. Well, or it could be because there's blunt force trauma to the trachea. And so, yeah, the biggest issue was not just reframing, it was asking questions at all.
Here's Monroe County Prosecutor Chris Gall.
You know, if you ask a victim, did you experience a tunneling of your vision? Did you experience a roaring sound in your ears? Then those are quite likely the kinds of subjective sensory experiences that a victim of strangulation will say, yes, I did. That's right. And then if the medical provider asks about that and includes it in the record, the medical records, it can come in that way, too. And then if you bring in an expert witness who will say, typically, according to the research, a strangulation victim would experience a tunneling of their vision and a roaring sound in their ears. Why, then it's the third time the jury has heard that. And then it's not just a he said, she said case, as some people refer to it. It's a case where the victim's statement is corroborated from two other sources, and the jury is then convinced that beyond a reasonable doubt that what they're hearing from the victim is, in fact, true.
McKay says, like first responders, prosecutors also have a learning curve when it comes to strangulation cases.
You have to understand what this evidence means. And then finally, you have to understand how to translate this evidence to a jury so that they can understand it. You know, how can they understand that having, you know, flashes in their vision is evidence of the blood flow being impeded? You have to understand how to portray that evidence to the jury in a way that they understand it.
Gall says Monroe County sex crimes and domestic violence prosecutors have received training through McKay. Victims' assistants and support staff in his office also have received training. He's now working to get a strangulation supplement form based on McKay's work implemented locally. He's assembled a working group with representatives from local law enforcement, Bloomington Hospital, and Middleway House. Gall anticipates the working group will develop an implementation plan over the next 3 months. For WFHB, I'm Sarah Vaughn.